content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Bahati Mutisia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazine. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Teen Vogue. Our first article today is titled, COVID Anniversary Anxiety is Real. Here's How to Cope. This article is by Liv McConnell, and it was published March 12, 2021. It started as February crept toward March. Posts on social media began to appear asking if anyone else was in a weird funk for no reason, as one friend on my timeline put it. A tweet from February 26th claiming not to know a single person who wasn't having an inexplicably garbage couple of weeks, the worst one of the whole pandemic even, was liked more than 20,000 times. Since then, texts from friends have confirmed the heightened stress they're somehow, after a year of extreme stress, able to feel, and I've been reaching for my go-to soothers, baths and Golden Girls episodes, with a restless regularity. Most of the messages I saw and sent spoke to a two-part theme: a mounting mutual sense of dread coupled with confusion over that dread. And the confusion makes sense. After all, we've had months, a whole 12 of them for most of us in the U.S., to process and adapt as best we can to life under COVID-19's siege. Now, after a year of unending anguish, from the more than 530,000 lives lost to the virus in the U.S. alone, the historic joblessness, ongoing police brutality against black bodies, climate disasters, and a violent attempt to overthrow our nation's democracy, there's finally a bright spot on the horizon. New COVID-19 cases are a fraction of what they were at the January peak, and good news about vaccine efficacy, if not always its accessibility, continues to rise. We're beginning to consider what stitched back together versions of our lives can look like by year's end, a line of thinking that brings up plenty of anxieties in its own right, but also unmistakably carries with it the promise of relief. This collective hope, arguably our first meaningful dose of it since the pandemic started, is something many of us are, on a rational level, reveling in. And yet, underneath that optimism, unease festers. Why the uptick in anxiety now? The answer could lie in at least partially in something trauma experts refer to as the anniversary reaction. According to New York State's Official of Mental Health, as a trauma representing date approaches, survivors of that trauma report a return of restlessness and fear. Psychological literature calls it the anniversary reaction and defines it as an individual's response to unresolved grief resulting from significant losses. The reaction, this description continues, can involve several days or even weeks of anxiety, anger, nightmares, flashbacks, depression, or fear. The pandemic is a trauma we've all collectively sustained. And with the one-year COVID anniversary of the pandemic upending life in the U.S. here, it was on March 11th, 2020, that the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a pandemic, and stay-at-home orders successfully went into effect soon after. It isn't a stretch to think we'll react accordingly. That's a view supported by many of the experts I heard from, including Beth Tyson, M.A., a psychotherapist who specializes in grief and trauma. The onset of COVID-19 in early March 2020 was a collective or mass trauma that impacted the entire world for the first time in our living history, Tyson said. Anniversaries of traumatic events typically stir up intense emotional reactions, and the one-year mark of COVID-19 will do the same. That's a reality that many therapists and mental health professionals already report seeing in patients. The anticipation of the anniversary also causes an increase in symptoms, and we are already seeing it. Joanna Philidor, LMFT, who specializes in the treatment of trauma, said, "People are feeling burned out, powerless, and helpless. Others are feeling trapped. Typical coping skills aren't as effective anymore, which leads to more anxiety and depression. A lot of people are reaching out for support." Miera Elias, LCSW, LICSW, TCTSYF, a psychotherapist whose work is in the field of trauma, grief, and loss for over a decade, says that some people may not even realize they're feeling more anxious because they are passing traumatic milestones. Even still, our bodies have a way of remembering, even if our conscious minds don't. As Tyson explains it, this manifestation of trauma serves a purpose. It's there to help steer us in the direction of safety and is often triggered by certain factors in our environment, including changes of season as well as specific dates on the calendar. Our brains react to a perceived threat as if it is a real threat, and it triggers a need to reach for safety. What complicates this need is that many of us can't yet become, because the pandemic is still very much ongoing. Because of that, some experts use other language to describe what's happening. Roxanne Cohen-Silver, PhD, a professor of psychological science, medicine, and public health at University of California, Irvine, has led multiple studies examining the mental health impact of national disasters, and in September, testified to Congress on the cascading collective trauma effect, of COVID, climate crisis, and social injustice. Calling the past year unlike anything I've ever studied, she believes that rather than an anniversary reaction, what many are now grappling with is the cumulative mental health impact of an extreme and continuing chronic stressor. I use the metaphor of a war, which is where there's a chronic stressor. We don't know when it's going to end, and we don't know how bad it's going to get, she says. But as Cohen-Silver is quick to clarify, for many individuals, the past year's collective trauma is also compounded by personal traumas that do have dates attached, such as the loss of a loved one, or even the loss of a milestone or life event, like a graduation or a wedding. We have lost both the lives of hundreds of thousands of people, and we've also lost hopes and opportunities and life experiences, she said. Taken together, that combination of individual and collective loss is incredibly heavy, and it could be resulting in something that David Bond, LCSW, Director of Behavioral Health at Blue Shield of California, calls complicated trauma, made all the worse by our chronic exposure to it. He compared it to holding a 2-pound weight. If you held it there for a few minutes, fine, not a big deal. But if you held it there for an hour, your arm would get very stressed, muscles would be fatigued, and other people might say, "But you're only holding 2 pounds," he said. The difference is that you've been holding it for such a long time that your body just can't anymore. This, he says, is where the real danger comes in. When a pain that you would have been able to process and more easily recover from is an acute event stretched into something sustained. And for those who already struggled with mental health prior to the pandemic especially, the strain could translate to health impacts because of an inability to get away from the trauma. This inability to get away has not been evenly felt because the impact of the pandemic has not been evenly applied. It's those from marginalized and under-resourced communities, whose mental health was already more likely to be vulnerable before the pandemic, who have borne the greatest impact of the virus's health and economic consequences. Speaking from the perspective of both a Black person and mental health professional, the one-year anniversary of COVID-19 in the United States brings up feelings of unease, discomfort, and uncertainty, Atlanta-based psychotherapist Amira Johnson, MSW, said. Black people suffer the most in the United States mentally, physically, and emotionally, yet don't receive the care that we need for three main reasons: stigma, mistrust, and fear, and resources. Black people in the U.S., as it is true for those from Latinx, Indigenous, and Asian American communities, are significantly more likely than white people to know someone who died from COVID-19 or to have experienced a COVID-19 hospitalization themselves. That's a fresh layer of grief and pain to work through on top of other racism-rooted traumas, making Black communities in desperate need of mental health services, Johnson said. Historically, however, there have not been many advocates for this group of people that have the ability to link them with service providers, specifically ones they can relate to and afford, she added. The presence of community-based trauma impacts what healing from individual grief, losses, and trauma looks like, and vice versa. As Bond put it, we need to see healing happen on the community level in order to feel its effects personally. When you experience community trauma, the recovery is going to require the community around us to get better, he said. It's not just an individual thing. If you were in a car accident, this is about your personal psychological trauma. But this is community trauma on a national and global level. So we're looking not just to our own healing, but the healing of all the people in the communities we live in. Community can be seen not just as something needed to be healed, but also the space where that healing happens. And that's true whether your uptick in anxiety is due to COVID's impending anniversary, the fact that you're beginning to process the impact of the chronic, complicated trauma, or some combination of the two, according to Sanjay Nath, a psychologist and professor of graduate clinical psychology at Widener University. In terms of coping, it's important to harness systems and communities that might help, whether that be the mental health community or government assistance systems, employer assistance systems, or our school and nonprofit systems, Nath said. While often coping is framed at an individual level, what can I do? Sometimes the focus on self-care for the body, mind, and spirit puts the burden back on individuals to figure it out and take on the task of coping. Ideally, there's a balance of self-care and self-coping and other care and other coping that is situated and grounded in relationships. On the intimate community level, trauma-informed therapist Charna Castle, MFT, recommends preemptively acknowledging the fact a difficult anniversary is on the horizon this month and preparing for its potential emotional toll accordingly. Set up a call with friends or family members who are skillful listeners, or arrange for someone in your pod to come hang out with you, Castle said. Spend time in nature to gain perspective and feel more grounded. And of course, meet basic needs such as nutrition and sleep, which will help you feel more regulated in general. In addition to creating structure and looking just enough ahead to ensure you feel supported, Johnson also stressed the importance of staying attuned to the present, especially if you're already struggling with heightened anxiety. Although it's important to have a life plan and understanding of one's next steps, it's also important to stay in the present moment and be grounded within it, she said, adding that mindfulness-based activities like journaling, meditating, or going for a walk can help. As cliche as it sounds, collectively, we need to take life one day at a time right now, which, in a way, will help us appreciate life even more because we're actually experiencing it and living rather than just striving and surviving. The next article is titled, Breonna Taylor is on young gun activist minds as they fight for change. In this letter, young Black activists reflect on the one-year anniversary of Breonna Taylor's death and the ongoing fight for justice. This is by LaTayla Billingsley, Jayla Hempfill, Celeste Iroa, Michaela Jordan, Ade Asadolar Hernandez, Ryan Pascal, and Taina Patterson. And this was published March 13th, 2021. Dear Breonna, it's been 1 year. 1 year since you were taken by police gun violence. A year since your family, friends, colleagues, and others lost a bright light. And a year since we lost another Black woman with dreams, ambitions, and her whole life in front of her. You were taken too soon, like too many others. Atatiana Jefferson, Corinne Gaines, Michelle Cousseau, and so many others whose names we don't even know. Your death wasn't the first to wake us up and remind us what it means to be a Black woman in the United States, but it was different. Things changed when we heard your story. It's unbelievable that it's already been a year since your death, but perhaps that's because the nation didn't learn who you were until months later. Something that happens too often after Black people are shot and killed, particularly by police. We learned of your death and took to the streets, social media, and any other platform we could to say your name and tell your story. Too often, the range about police violence is concentrated and fleeting. The broader conversation only lasts a short period of time. Maybe it's days, maybe weeks, maybe months if we're lucky. But for us, it's different. As young Black women, we hold your story in everything we do. We see you and your dreams in ourselves. In the past year, we have taken our anger and pain and turned them into action. We registered voters, even though many of us are still too young to vote ourselves. We led our peers, friends, and communities in an effort to prevent what happened to you from happening to anyone else. We raised awareness about the gun violence and the police violence crisis, both of which disproportionately affect Black people in the United States. For as long as we can remember, we've been scared we might be the next victim of senseless gun violence. And it's more than just gun violence in schools. We are fighting against all kinds of gun violence, including police shootings, gun homicides in cities, gun suicides, and domestic violence in our homes. Every day in our country, more than 100 people die from gun violence, and more than 230 are shot and wounded, according to Every Town for Gun Safety. But for far too long, many of our so-called leaders have only offered thoughts and prayers in response to this preventable crisis. And for many young Black women, gun violence is personal. An Every Town report cited CDC data that found Black children and teens are 14 times as likely as our white peers to die by gun violence nationwide, and firearms are the leading cause of death for children and teens in the United States. With COVID-19, we have seen again how systemic racism and inequalities have created another public health crisis that makes a disproportionate toll on Black communities. The underlying reason is clear. Decades of underinvestment in these neighborhoods have created the environments in which public health crises like COVID-19 and gun violence thrive. That said, there has been progress in the last year. There are gun sense champions in the White House and many gun sense lawmakers in both chambers of Congress. The House of Representatives just passed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, which would take several initial but necessary steps to address police brutality, racial profiling, and other fundamental problems in our law enforcement system. And on Thursday, other life-saving gun safety measures passed in the House of Representatives, including legislation to require background checks on all gun sales and to close the Charleston loophole, which allows gun sales to move forward without the necessary background check. Legislation to close the deadly dating partner and stalker loopholes has also been introduced in the House. In state houses around the country, volunteers with Students Demand Action have been advocating for gun safety, and there is still more work to do. Make no mistake, it's exhausting work. Some days we are sick and tired of being sick and tired, as Fannie Lou Hamer famously said. Tired of the sexism from being women and the racism from being Black. Tired of screaming to have our voices heard, work recognized, and lives protected. Even though we did not know you personally, we want to thank you, Brianna. Thank you for being a woman we can look up to. We honor you today and every day, and we will continue fighting for your justice. With admiration, Latayla, Jayla, Celeste, Michaela, Ade, Ryan, and Taina. Latayla Billingsley is a high school student, member of the Students Demand Action National Advisory Board in Georgia, and a gun violence survivor. Jayla Hemphill is a high school student and volunteer with Students Demand Action in Colorado. Celeste Iroya is a student at University of Maryland and also a gun violence survivor. Michaela Jordan is a high school student and a member of the Students Demand Action National Advisory Board in Alabama. Ade Asadola Hernandez is a first-year student at University of Chicago and a member of the Students Demand Action National Advisory Board. Ryan Pascal is a volunteer of Students Demand Action in California and an incoming student at Yale University in 2022. And Taina Patterson is a gun violence survivor, an Everytown Survivor Fellow, and a volunteer leader with Students Demand Action in Florida. And with the short time that we have left, I think I'll revisit an article still from Teen Vogue, but I believe part of it I read before. This is titled, "The Best Advice from Therapists from 50 Different People." And I just want to read a few, given that we're coming up on the, or we are currently at the anniversary of the COVID-19 pandemic shutdown. So Deja in this article states that her therapist advice was, make mental lists of all the things you can control in a situation and put positive power to those. Deja's thoughts on this advice: if someone was making decisions that upset me, I wasn't able to change what they were doing, but I could change my response to that behavior. Or I can change the amount of communication I have with that person. Evelyn's therapist's advice was, change your perspective and everything else will fall into place. Evelyn's thoughts: I would make situations out of nothing, speak impulsively, and had moments where I would be screaming to get my point across. A lot of it stemmed from not feeling that I was up to my family standards. My therapist made me realize that it's my mindset that has to change and my overall outlook on my natural abilities to succeed. Dominique, her therapist's advice was trust yourself. Dominique's thoughts? It stopped me in my tracks. I grew up with the message that I don't know what's best for me or that I'm incapable of knowing, and it took going to therapy and getting that reminder to guide me back on track. Phyllis, therapist's advice, if a plane goes down, you have to put your mask on before you help someone else. Phyllis's thoughts. During my junior year, I was taking a lot of responsibilities for myself and my family. Oftentimes, my family obligations went above my own needs. My therapist was trying to convey the message that in order for me to get to a place where I can take care of my family, first, I had to focus on my needs and take care of myself. Fernando, his therapist's advice, as long as it makes sense to you, that's all that should matter. Fernando's thoughts. I felt empowered to take the reins of my life. Tiffany, her therapist's advice, you cannot control every situation you enter, but you can control how you react to the situation. Tiffany's thoughts. My therapist is never afraid to call me out on my stuff. Heather, her therapist said, always come back to you. Others' actions are not personal. They are simply looking through the lens of their own past. Heather's thoughts, we feel like the world is happening to us. We don't realize that we can still find peace and happiness in chaos. Finding that place means having a connection within. It's been absolutely life-altering to take this power back. Alondria's therapist said, we don't try, we do. Alondria's thoughts, I remember that we always have a choice in life. Every day, we have to make a conscious effort to be better, to better ourselves through the choices we make. All right, well, we have now run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazine. Please be sure to listen next time. We hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm Bahati Mutisia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.